listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Hashtag not one more. And we'll get into that as we continue through the day. But up until from the founding of the Republic until 77, I guess it was, that the Boston versus Bilotti case was decided. The spending of money to influence politics, whether it was to encourage people to vote for somebody or whether it was to encourage a politician to do a particular thing, the spending of money was considered conduct. And conduct was something that could be regulated. In fact, in the Buckley versus Vallejo decision in 1976, the Supreme Court affirmed that spending money for political purposes was conduct and could therefore be regulated by Congress. Leading to a leading to actually upholding and affirming in some ways many of the laws that had come about with regard to the legalized bribery of members of Congress and the White House out of the Nixon scandals of the early 70s. And leading and setting the stage for things like McCain-Feingold. And then in 2010, the Supreme Court took this very bizarre position that the spending of money to influence political activity, a position that certainly George Washington would not have agreed with, nor anyone since then, was not actually conduct. It was speech in and of itself, and therefore it was mystically protected by the First Amendment, which protects speech, but does not protect conduct other than association. The freedom of association is protected by the First Amendment, but the freedom of, it protects freedom of speech. So Harry Reid has suggested, and both Democrats and Republicans, and this is something where it's startling how broad, if you go to the movetoamend.org coalition, over 500 communities now have voted for this thing, or 17 states have voted for an amendment to the Constitution that would say that we are going to go back to the understanding of spending money as a behavior, as a conduct, as opposed to speech, which can therefore be regulated by we the people in ways so that it can't corrupt our democracy. Peter Schiff is with us. He is the host of the Peter Schiff Show, an investment advisor, CEO, and chief global strategist of the Euro-Pacific Capital. Schiff Radio, S-C-H-I-F-F Radio.com is his website. And Peter, if I understand this right, you are of the opinion that spending money is actually speaking. Go ahead.
I would like to go a step further. I'd like to get rid of all the campaign's finance laws that are currently on the books. I don't think the government should get involved in this issue.
So you would like us to live in a country where basically the oligarchs run the show, sort of like Ukraine.
Well, look who runs the show now. I mean, almost everybody gets reelected. We have a nation of career politicians. Some of these guys have been there for their entire lives. They've never even been in a private.
They're not running the show, and you and I both know it.
Well, I ran for Senate. I don't know if you ever ran for office, but
no,
I actually ran. No. And the most difficult part of my running was complying with campaign finance laws. And the reason I may never run again was because I don't want to have to deal with that bureaucracy. It's the worst part. It's the reason that the only way you can be successful in politics today is to be a career politician with lots of special interests vying for you to use their power to their benefit, or you can be a gazillionaire and you can self-finance. But if you're just a concerned citizen who wants to take time out of his life and go to Washington for a term or two to help solve problems, you don't have a chance.
Well, you know, Arizona and Maine looked at this.
Maybe you would.
Arizona and Maine looked at this situation that you're describing so eloquently, Peter. And they said, here's an easy solution. And Portland, Oregon did. Actually, I lived in Portland when they passed this law. Said, if you can get, in the case of Portland, it was, if you can get 1,000 people to give you $5 and registered voters give you $5 and sign a petition that they support you to be on the ballot, then the city will give you $100,000, and we will match anything that is spent against you. In other words, publicly funded elections. Arizona had publicly funded elections for about 6 years. Maine had them for 4 years. During that period of time, the number of people who were average working Joes and literally housewives who came into the political arena increased by more than 300% in Arizona, more than 200% in Maine. there was a real shot of average people coming into the political arena. Same thing in Portland. Then the Supreme Court said, wait a minute, you're regulating speech.
Just not on the federal level, but they have public financing of state offices. I'm not in favor of
that. But then the Supreme Court struck those things down, Peter.
We have.
But then the Supreme Court came along and said, Arizona, Maine, sorry, you can't have that because you are regulating, you know, Scalia, the 5-4 decisions. You cannot have that because you are regulating speech. And the spending of money is speech. And this seems to me like, let's just turn America over to the billionaires.
Well, right now, the billionaires that have power, if they have power, it's through political connections. What I want to do is take away the power from Washington.
How?
So the only way billionaires can get rich is by solving my problem, by coming up with products that I want to buy that make my life better.
No, that's not true, and you know that that's not true. The majority of billionaires in the United States, in terms of billions, inherited their money. The five Walton heirs have more wealth than the bottom 31% of America. They inherited that money. The Koch brothers have $80 billion. They inherited their first few billion from their daddy.
They made all that money. But would you have preferred it if Sam Walton, before he died, just dismantled Walmart, shut down all the stores, fired all his workers, and blown all his money on wine and women so that he didn't leave anything to his...
You're putting out a complete straw man argument. What I'm saying is the consequence of doing away with all campaign finance laws and asserting, as Scalia has asserted in a 5-4 decision, and as John Paul Stevens just wrote an eloquent book saying Scalia is nuts on this, is that somehow spending, if a billionaire spends money, that is the same thing as speech. And I've got probably about $140 in my right-hand pocket right now in my pants, and I haven't heard a peep from it all day.
Yeah, well, look, I can tell you the most expensive thing that I had to encounter when I ran for office was all the people I had to hire, all the accountants, all the bureaucrats, to keep track of the money so that I can stay in compliance.
If that's what it takes to have a Democratic Republic, what's wrong with it?
Maybe a $10,000 fine because I didn't report everything the right way.
Peter, your laziness is not my problem.
No, it's not laziness. It's raising the bar. The reason it's so expensive to run for office is because candidates have to follow all these ridiculous rules and regulations.
No, it's so expensive to run for office because
campaigns would be a lot less expensive because more people could run.
No. The reason why it's so expensive to run for office is because television advertising costs a fortune, and they jack their rates up around election time. And this is why the media will not take on this issue. It's why they don't even report on it. I mean, you've got almost 20 states that have passed resolutions statewide where the majority of people in the state have said money is not speech. It's property. Spending money is not speech. It's behavior. It should be regulated. The majority and the media will not even report on it because where does that money go? It goes to the media. You may have had to hire an accountant and a lawyer, and you have my sympathies. But I'm sorry, freedom ain't free.
But none of this is serving the interest of the electorate. We're not getting better representatives. The representatives are all bought.
Arizona and Maine got better representatives for a couple of years.
Politician who's got all the special interests backing him.
So let's get the special interests out by saying that money is not speech. And
that's
the spending of money is behavior.
They're still going to be there. All these government laws just make it worse. Let's just have freedom. Let's count on that.
Have freedom for the billionaires, but not for the average guy. That's your position.
You spend a lot of money on television because the average American is too dumb to actually research the issues, and they're influenced by a 30-second commercial. I mean, we shouldn't even need commercials. I mean, you can put your platform.
So you want to ban commercials?
People can research you and see what you stand for.
So you want to ban commercials?
I don't want to ban them. It's just unfair.
Okay, so let's... Yeah, right. And that's why nobody buys advertised products and why nobody bothers advertising, right? Peter Schiff, you can read it at schiffradio.com. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Peter, I'm sorry. I meant to give you the last word. Thank you for being with us, Peter.
Bye.
Good talking with you. Schiff Radio, schiffradio.com. We'll be back. Amazing. The people are too stupid, and when they listen, and when they listen to ads, if they're influenced by the ads, they're stupid, right? Sharon, in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Sharon, what's on your mind?
Hi, I was just I heard your thing about the not one more postcard deal this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Doing it here.
Yeah, I'm going to do it again as soon as we end this break. I should say to all of our Free Speech TV viewers, all this week we are live in the 3 to 6 time period. Starting next week, we will be time delayed for 2 weeks, and then we'll be live noon to 3. So anyway, back to Sharon.
Yeah, I was out doing errands at the time, so I raced right over to the post office to get some cards.
Good on you.
And I was telling the postman what I was going to do and why. And I said, well, I figure, he says, how many do you want? And I said, well, let's see, 3 state officials, 2 for my state, or 3 federals, 2 for the state, 1 for Mitch McConnell, 1 for Harry Reid. And he says, well, how about the NRA?
Wow.
And I went, oh, yeah, send one to the NRA.
That's
and I'm not
idea.
Sure what the current president's name is.
Of the NRA?
I think
it's Wayne. No, Wayne LaPierre is the vice president. He's the front guy.
Oh, I thought he was out.
No, he's still there. He's very much the face of the NRA, but he's not the actual president.
Well,
Shane is Googling it as we speak. Hang on. It's James Porter II. So, but you could send it to Wayne LaPierre. I mean, you know,
I think we should paper the NRA with those postcards too.
Yeah. Not one more. I'm with you. Not one more. This was the anguished cry of Richard Martinez, the father of Chris Martinez, the young man who was shot by this deranged killer over the weekend. And he said, everybody just get a postcard or get postcards and send them to your members of Congress. Send them to any politician you know. You know, you might want to send them to your town council, to your city council, to your local commissioners, or whatever they are. You know, any politicians you know, saying not one more. And I think it's brilliant. Sharon, the suggestion of adding the NRA to that list, that's great. Thank you so much. Thanks for the call. And do you have the clip? Let's play it. Here he is.
And so my original thought was that I should ask you on behalf of Christopher and the other families that agree with this approach to go out and buy a pack of postcards, write 3 words, not one more, and then find the names and address of every politician you can possibly think of and send that message.
Yeah, and so we tweeted out the hashtag not one more this morning. I encourage you to do that. We did it from the @Tom_Hartman account, which is our radio show account, TV show account. And hashtag not one more. And I went to Eleanor Holmes Norton's site. She represents me in the United States House of Representatives. And I wrote one. Shane wrote one. Danielle wrote one. Jim wrote one. Louise wrote one. They're right here. We had some old Walking Your Blues Away promotional postcards, and we just wrote not one more on them and addressed them and put the stamps, and they're going to go in the mail tonight. You should do the same. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Sam Cedar, host of the Majority Report, co-host of Ring of Fire Radio, majority.fm, ringoffireradio.com. Sam Cedar, welcome back to our show, Sam.
Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Now, I understand that you have an announcement. Here's the appropriate. Go for it.
Well, thank you. Well, as you know, Tom, my understanding is that you are moving to 12 to 3. Do I have that correct?
Starting next week, yes, sir.
And, it's going to leave about a 3-hour hole in the progressive talk lineup. So we are expanding Ring of Fire to a daily show. We're going to continue to do the weekend show. I'm going to hold down the fort. Bobby Kennedy and Mike Papantonio will be joining me as they can, of course, during the week. But we're going to do 3 hours a day, and we're back following you again, Tom. So it's always a pleasure.
Just like back in the...
It's like old times.
Yeah, it's like back when we were on Air America and you followed me. Actually, back then you followed me by 3 hours. Now you'll be following me by 3 minutes.
Actually, you know what? I think back in those days, I was your lead-in because I was doing 9 to noon when you came on 12 to 3, I think, back
in
that slot.
Yeah,
so,
you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
We moved around a lot in those days, so it's hard to keep track.
Yeah, I don't think it was a good thing for the format, frankly. But anyway, here we are.
I would agree,
yeah.
Indeed, and here we are. So I'm very excited. I'm taking a couple of days off of my podcast. It's in the hands of my producers for the next couple of days, just gearing up, getting ready to go back on, live every day, 3 to 6.
That's great. That is absolutely great, Sam. It couldn't happen to a better person, and you are a consummate professional. You have, been in this industry for years and years. You've stuck with even after Air America went away, you stuck with your Majority Report show as a podcast and kept it going and kept it solid and stable. And you're the guy, man. You're the rock. I'm so glad that you're doing this. Glad that you're doing this.
I appreciate it, and I've obviously, I've been a huge fan of yours. On day one of me entering into radio, I think you were one of our first guests on the show that Janine Garofalo and I did when we launched. And you are for me a big inspiration because the amount of work that you do on a daily basis. I don't know how you do it. I speculate you sleep only about a half hour a day. But,
well, thank you, Sam. And I should point out, for our listeners and our viewers that you and I pretty much share the same politics. I don't know of any areas where we have any substantial disagreements. So people are going to hear, they're going to get their daily dose of good progressive politics. They're going to learn how to win the water cooler wars and how to talk back to crazies and get the talking points that they need and the affirmation of what actually is real in this world, just from a different guy in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I think that's right. In fact, I know you just had a nice chat with Peter Schiff.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've had I've been on his program. His brother has called into my program. I have spent a lot of time particularly talking to libertarians as of late because I think there's a lot of young people who are attracted to that. I mean, I hesitate to call it an ideology. It's really just a sort of a strange philosophy in theory, and in practice it really is simply a way of creating a what I think is a feudal system in this country and or amounts to one. And
yeah.
So I spent a lot of time talking to libertarians. I'll talk to conservatives to the extent that they'll talk to me. But the bottom line, and I think you brought this up in your conversation with Peter Schiff, is that there are a lot of stories that the corporate media just simply will not touch, and they won't touch it because, they've got either a parent company that has some type of vested interest in the story not being reported upon or being reported upon in a certain way, or they have just a direct interest, like you mentioned, campaign finance. The National Association of Broadcasters, one of their greatest revenue streams are these elections that take place every 2 and 4 years. And so, of course, they're not going to talk about campaign finance because they're going to be the biggest losers in this. And so there's a lot of stories like that that I know that you cover, and it's stuff that I like to touch upon. And, and certainly you've been on this beat for a long time. I read Screwed multiple times. And the fact of the matter is that we have moved from a plutonomy into a plutocracy. There's plenty of academic studies upon it, but I think people realize it in their gut. And so we've got a big fight that's not just ideological per se, but is, let's face it, it's a class war. And it's being waged whether or not we want to engage in it. And so I'm someone who wants to engage in it.
Yeah, and good on you for that. And as Warren Buffett said, yes, there is a class war, and my class is winning, his class, Warren
right.
Buffett's, the billionaires. and we are the loyal opposition. And it's so weird when conservatives on talk radio present themselves as the loyal opposition, when in fact they're the shills for the billionaires. By the way, I always refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. What do you think?
That's right. Well, I think that's true, too. I mean, I think to a certain extent, I think that's an accurate description of their politics. Yeah. But
because economically, they're Republicans, and they say that we should do away with drug laws and prostitution laws, right? So, hey, they're Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, period.
Right. And, you know, to a certain extent, I think that's right. I think they tend to be a little bit less conservative socially unless they're running for office.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, maybe I should amend it and say they're Republicans who want to smoke dope, get laid, and they don't care if their gay brother gets married.
Yes, unless they're running for office.
Yes.
I would add last caveat.
Yeah, there you go. Sam Seder, host of the Majority Report and Ring of Fire Radio, co-host of Ring of Fire Radio, going to be bringing Ring of Fire Radio to this day part starting next week. Sam, majority.fm, ringoffireradio.com. Sam, so great to hear your voice. Thanks so much for being there for us, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great talking with you, Sam. We'll, and we will talk again, no doubt. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can check out Sam if you are unfamiliar with him over at majority.fm. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, boy, what a day. A lot going on. So I told you about this these postcards. I want to emphasize this one more time. I think this is so such a great idea. And it's like, you know, after the Newtown massacre, there were a number of Newtown parents who went on the road and they did the talk shows and the Saturday morning shows and the morning TV shows and Today and whatnot. And they were so polite. And they were so nice. And now, after this most recent massacre, we have Richard Martinez, if I'm remembering his name correctly. Is that it? Yeah. It is, Richard Martinez, yeah. Who is not so nice and polite. He is pounding his fist on the table and speaking out and bursting into tears on camera and being a human being with whom we can all empathize, talking about how he had his son for 20 years and imagine the Newtown parents who only had their kids for 5 or 6 years and no more, not one more. And he said, everybody, get a postcard, go to the, you know, get a postcard. We have some postcards kicking around the office here. They're old promotional postcards for my book, Walking Your Blues Away, that the publisher sent us from Inner Traditions. And we just, marked out the promotional stuff and instead wrote, not one more on them. That's, he said, write a postcard and write 3 words on it, not one more. And send it to your elected member of Congress. And so I'm sending one to Eleanor Holmes Norton, and Louise is sending one to President Obama, and Danielle is sending one to Senator Barbara Mikulski, and Jim is sending one to Eric Cantor, who represents him. Jim, you have my sympathies. And Shane is sending one to Senator Ben Cardin. So, we're sending them, and you can send 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10. Send them to your city council. Send them to your state senator. Send them to your state assemblyman or woman. Send them to your state representative. Send them to your U.S. member of the House of Representatives. Living here in Washington, D.C., I don't have a senator. And, in fact, my representative, Eleanor Holmes Norton, does not have a vote in Congress, but she occasionally can speak. And we just want to flood Congress, not one more. And when I went over to Eleanor Holmes Norton's website to get her address to fill out the postcard, you click the contact link, and one of the contact options is send an email. And so I sent an email that said not one more as well. And then we had a caller who called into the show a little earlier who said that she went to the post office to buy a bunch of postcards, and she was talking to the postal clerk there who said, and she was telling this person why she was buying the postcards, and the postal clerk or the postmaster, small town presumably, said, why not send one to the NRA too? Hey, brilliant. Brilliant. Clay in Shelton, Washington, listening on KMAS. Hey, Clay, what's on your mind? Clay, you are on the air. play is not on the air. George in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You are on the air. What's up, George?
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
Not one more.
Yeah,
not
amen.
One more. And the idea of sending one to the NRA is brilliant. I'm going to have to get another postcard.
Yeah.
I would like to thank you very much for your complete and articulate dissertation on the history of the Second Amendment. That's something that should be taught to every kid in junior high school and high school so that we have an understanding of that important part of our Constitution. As your commercials on CBT here in Chicago say, helping you win the water cooler wars.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the kind of ammunition we need.
I was back three long hours ago for people who are just tuning in. I went through the how the original Second Amendment said that a well-armed militia was necessary to the security of a free country. And Patrick Henry went nuts about this because he was a slave. He was the largest slaveholder in Virginia. And he said, no, you've got to James Madison, he said, you've got to rewrite this, because if we have a national army and they impress our slaves, they can draft our slaves and they can free our slaves, and they will do it if some guy like John Adams becomes president who doesn't like slavery, which is exactly what happened after George Washington left. And he said, therefore, we need the amendment to say for the security of a free state, not a free country, so that the state of Virginia can maintain their slave patrols, their militia. And James Madison, dutifully, in order to get Virginia to sign on to ratify the Constitution, changed the Second Amendment. And you can read it right now in the Second Amendment. It says for the security of a free state, not a free country. And you can read the original draft that Madison wrote, said a free country. And there's a difference between a country and a state in this country. Back to you, George.
And that has led us directly to where we are today with the situation in Sandy Hook and Santa Barbara. And I have a couple small points to make. They may sound a bit glib, and I don't mean them to be, but you had an earlier caller who was a pro-gun person who listened to everything you had to say and in the end didn't really agree with any of it, but he did congratulate you for knowing the difference between a magazine and a clip. It occurred to me that if I was one of those shot in Santa Barbara, as I was bleeding to death on the ground, I would think to myself, thank God I was shot by a bullet that came out of a clip instead of a magazine.
Right.
Really.
Right.
And also, the pro-gun people are trying to make a big deal about the fact that he murdered three people initially with a knife.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to bet that he backed up those knife attacks with a gun in his holster. I can't believe that this guy, who, based on what I've seen on the tape, looked like a wimp and a nerd, would go in to assault people with a knife if he didn't have a gun on.
Well, he might have held a gun to each one of their heads, and just decided to save his bullets. You know, he wanted to use those bullets on the girls, on the women. You know, he was going to go after the sorority women, it's hard to get inside or even speculate about what's going on inside the mind of someone like that. But if he was as obsessive about killing women, his whole misogynist worldview, as it appears from what I've seen in the media, then it would make a bizarre, twisted certain amount of sense that he would use the gun to restrain his roommates, you know, to threaten them while he stabbed them. I think you're probably right, George. I don't know. I mean, the police and the crime scene investigators will be able to tell us that someday, but yeah, makes a lot of sense. George, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for your kind words. Ray in Merrick, New York, you're on the air. Hey, Ray.
Hi, Tom. I want to discuss something about Newtown.
Yes, sir.
The fellow that you was on before about sending the postcards.
Yeah.
That's a nice step, but let me just tell you something. I was a media man, planner, buyer in New York City for 25 years. Worked on all kinds of accounts. What you're dealing with now is something that has to be addressed on the same kind of level as the NRA does. And this is simply, well, you better buckle your seat up, because here it goes. You go to those parents who have lost their children, and you get the best photographs that you can of their happiest days, which you've all seen on TV. Now you've got to go to the governor of the state of Connecticut and get the autopsy pictures of those children as they were brought in to the room, those who were shot 3, 4, 5 times.
Yeah, in many cases, their bodies actually dismembered because the bullets were so powerful. and they were hit so often.
That's the picture. That's the picture you have to take of little Janie and little Dye, whoever it may be.
Yeah.
You take those pitches, and if you have to, you put the pressure on the governor. This is a tough, tough thing for those parents and the grandparents and anybody affiliated with those kids. But this is what you've got to do. You take those pitches and you run them side by side, not in mass, individuals. And you send them to every governor, every legislature in this federal, every legislature in the state. You post it on K Street, the trees and the post office box on the sidewalks.
You march in front of the NRA with them. This is the equivalent of the Right to Life movement carrying pictures of aborted fetuses.
You know, you don't carry them. You mail them, and you post them up in the middle of the night on their front doors and on every legislative and governmental office you can find.
Yeah.
And you do it, and you walk away.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't recommend that may or may not be against the law, and so I can't explicitly comment on it, but I get what you're saying, Ray, and it's time to as they say, go to the mattresses on this thing. I'm with you. Carlana in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carlana, what's up?
Two things. I wanted to talk about, I'm going to be running lasthours.org on public access TV during the month of June.
Oh, great. Our movie about the methane threat.
Yes, and I have to say that if you're doing another production, please have someone read what you have written on the screen, because no one can read that. It's not left on long enough, and so you should have someone read it. But at any rate, that's my excuse for running it. On each one, it repeats four times during the hour, so that people will possibly have time to read what's written. But it's every Monday night in the city of Pittsburgh, city limits.
That's
every
great.
Every Monday night at 9 p.m. and Comcast Channel 21.
Okay.
And Verizon Fios Channel 47.
Uh-huh.
And it'll be every Monday during the month of June.
Well, thank you, Carlana.
And what I wanted to say is that other public access television stations across the country, maybe there's a community producer who could submit it. I mean, different ones have different rules.
Sure.
But I submitted it as the community producer. And then I wanted to make a comment about the National Rifle Association.
Can you do it quickly, please? We have about 15 seconds.
They love it when there's a massacre, because they get more membership, they get more donations, and they dream up ways of making more money for themselves, such as after the children were shot.
I think you're right. I know you're right. But I think that we're reaching a critical mass where they may not love it anymore. I hope
you're
that's
listening
it's Carlana.
To the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There's that guy stepping on me again. Thank you for the call, Carlana. And I think the NRA's days are numbered, just like the tobacco lobby.
And welcome back, Tom Hartman. Ooh,
I was cooling down my brain. Yeah, we did a geeky science on that 2 weeks ago about how when people are yawning, they're actually trying to cool down their brains. I always thought that was fascinating. Tom, in Seattle, watching us on Free Speech TV on cable access, you have a comment for President Obama on global warming? Tom?
Oh, yes.
You are on the air, sir.
Hey, I just had a thought. I mean, all this extra rain we're getting from South America from cutting down trees, I guess, I suppose something kind of the weather changing. Is there some kind of infrastructure that were proposed by, I believe President Kennedy had a NWAPA project proposal to have things, all this rain that we're flooding we're getting, why is it we can't get some kind of infrastructure made to divert the water and pump it through an infrastructure up into the arid lands of the Midwest, West, and the Red River?
We may ultimately have to be looking at something like that, Tom. The atmosphere right now has 5% more moisture in it than it did when Reagan came into office. The atmosphere is rapidly, rapidly changing. And as a consequence of the hundreds of billions of tons of carbon that we have dumped into it, over 350 billion tons since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and you know, now it's mind-boggling, and as a result of that global warming, the atmosphere, a warmer atmosphere, is capable of holding more moisture, And because it holds more moisture. Yeah,
but it's centered. It seems to be centered in the dry, the coastal areas.
It what's happening is that where you have warm and cold air collide, you have storms form and the water precipitates out. And that collision zone is typically defined by the jet stream. The jet stream brings cold air down from the north and it confronts the southern, the equatorial warmer air. And the jet stream is running farther south now than it used to, which is why we were getting these polar vortexes during the winter, because the gradient, the temperature gradient, the difference between the mid-latitude temperatures and the polar temperatures has diminished because the North Pole is warming about six times faster than it's warming at these latitudes where we are. And so the problem is that there is so much instability in this global system. You combine that with the fact that over 90%, from the last few decades anyway, of the heat and carbon that has gone into the atmosphere has been absorbed by the oceans. And they may be reaching a point of saturation, or they may be reaching a tipping point where the oceans either start re-releasing that stuff or where they start melting the methane hydrate under the seas and, you know, just basically wipe us out, like happened during the Permian mass extinction. I mean, we're looking at some really serious heavy stuff here as a consequence of global warming. And this is the woman who called earlier who was talking about lasthours.org. If you go to that website, lasthours.org, there is a 12-minute video that you can watch that basically lays all this out. And I think you may find it interesting, Tom. I recommend it to you. Thanks for the call. But, yeah, times are changing, and we're going to have to adapt. We're going to have to change with them, or we're just not going to be here anymore. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour of 4 o'clock. Stick around. Here with you, and Bill in Bakersfield, California. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, how are you doing, Tom? I just want to say you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
I want to mention an incident that I was involved in with the Democratic Party here in Bakersfield last week.
Okay.
I was supposed to be trained to register people to vote as Democrats, and they were telling us how to approach certain ethnicities. If you were a black person, we were supposed to only talk about President Obama and Obamacare. If we approached Latinos, we were supposed to only talk about the DREAM Act and immigration reform. And if you're a white person, we're supposed to only talk about Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. And that, I felt, very offensive.
Yeah. Bill, do you work for the Republican Party?
No, I do not.
Okay.
I've been a Democrat since 1983.
Okay, then Bill, I would strongly suggest that you call the DNC headquarters here in Washington D.C. and turn in the person who told you those things. Ryan in Chicago. Hey, Ryan, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Great.
I just seen your TED Talk. Bravo.
Well, thank you.
I was listening to the libertarian that you had on. I believe his name was Peter.
Peter Schiff, yeah. I'm not sure he's a libertarian, but he was defending libertarian positions.
Yeah. I have a lot of, due to my age, I have a lot of friends that are libertarian or have libertarian views. I tend to try not to broad brush people like that, but the idea of libertarian in their views is not about freedom. It's about choice. When you're saying freedom, you're describing lack of responsibility. The most free man in the world is the one that has no responsibilities. The choices that they're asking for are the ability to not follow the rules.
Right.
When this libertarian view that they have is almost like the schoolyard bully. If there's no rules or anybody to regulate that bully from hitting everybody with a bat, the way that you counter that bully from hitting everybody with a bat is by everybody getting together and taking the bat away from the kid.
Right.
That's what a democracy provides for us citizens who don't have the biggest stick.
Yeah, it's an I, me, mine. It's an infantilism. It's arrested development. It's stunted maturity that leads to and that feeds libertarian thinking.
that view must be made very, very clear. The freedom that they're talking about is lack of responsibility.
Right, the freedom that the Koch brothers want is
their community.
Right, they want the freedom. The Koch brothers want the freedom to pollute more and to drill more oil and to not have to pay more taxes and be part of society. I get it. I get it. Brian, thank you very much. And it's obviously not just the Koch brothers. They're the low hanging fruit, but they put themselves in that position. John in Pacific Grove, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Oh, hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for listening to Progressive Voices on TuneIn Radio. What's up?
I wanted to call and just offer up an opposing argument for sending in those postcards.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you can remember right after Sandy Hook, there were a lot of liberals that wanted a symbolic vote in the Senate over an assault rifle ban. And I knew what a tough position Harry Reid was in because he was looking at the possibility of losing a lot of his red state Democratic senators. And that worries me a little bit. The gun control issue is an issue where we could alienate some blue dogs and send at least a few of those senators packing.
John, the majority of Republicans in the United States want there to be background checks on people. The majority of Republicans.
Background checks. Gun control. This was an assault rifle ban a national.
Not the majority of Republicans are in favor of an assault rifle ban. They're in favor of the Brady Bill, bringing back the Brady Bill. The majority of Republicans. Look it up.
Are you sure of that?
I am absolutely certain of that. These guys are not voting their constituents. These Republicans, the majority of Republicans in Congress are not. The majority of Republicans in America are. And you can find this in Pew, you can find it in Rasmussen, and you can find it over at it's a big polling company that the famous long-term, they've been around forever, whatever. Anyway, I'm sure of that. And the reason why the Republicans are not voting their constituents is because they're afraid that the NRA is going to take them out, that the NRA will support a primary opponent, that the NRA will destroy them in the next election, that the NRA will characterize them as anti-gun, whatever, So I hear this argument. Don't go there. You're going to lose, some Democrats who are hanging out by their fingernails in the red states. I've heard that argument also about women's rights and abortion and access to birth control and things like that. And I'm telling you, the majority of Republicans, it's amazing when you look at these majority studies, what people in this country actually support. This is a center-left country. Even the majority of Republicans on many, if not most, issues, they want stronger Social Security. They want stronger Medicaid. They want stronger Medicare. They think the people who, unemployment benefits should be extended. It is the elected members of Congress dancing to the tune of billionaires who are doing their bidding rather than yours and mine or even their own constituents. Lou in Chicago, listening on CPT. Hey, Lou, what's up?
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me on. I just finished reading a book called Reflections on Judging by Richard Posner. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a federal...
He's a legal scholar, yeah.
Yes.
He took apart, actually, Scalia's Heller decision.
In this book, he takes apart Scalia entirely.
Yeah.
He's no liberal.
Yeah.
No,
he's very conservative.
What amazed me is, especially in light of this talk about guns, is one of Scalia's tenets for interpretation is that you can tell the gist of a statute by its preamble. And the only one in the Bill of Rights that has a preamble is the Second Amendment, and you just read the preamble.
Right.
Which was what the purpose, a well-regulated militia.
Right. For necessary for the security of a free state. Right.
Whether it's a state or country, some guy going to a gun store and buying an AK-47 is not what does not constitute.
No, in fact, I would assert that it does the opposite. It diminishes the security of a free state or a free country. And we're seeing that right now. Lou, thank you very much. And let's remember, Heller was decided 5-4. And, it was five right wingers and Scalia writing the decision. And Scalia and Thomas hadn't been there.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And with us right now, I'm very, very pleased to have Professor William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Kansas at Missouri, the author of the book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He blogs over at neweconomicperspectives.org. Professor Black, welcome. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, but it's the University of Missouri at Kansas City.
Aha. Okay, we have a typo here. Thank you for fixing that. That makes perfect sense. You wrote this absolutely brilliant piece, Credit Suisse's Guilty Plea. The Wall Street Journal uses the right adjective to modify the wrong noun. People have been noticing that, you know, recently there was one bank that actually pled guilty to criminal activity. Other banks have been paying big fines, but we haven't seen any perp walks. We haven't seen any banks being taken down. What's going on? The banksters crashed the economy. Let's start at the beginning. Did the banksters crash our economy?
Yeah. So we have a crash because of the three most destructive epidemics of what we call the biz accounting control fraud in world history. And they are a massive fraud in the appraisal realm, where the banks coerced the appraisers to inflate the appraised value of a house, something no honest banker would do, but works really well as a fraud scheme. The second epidemic was liar's loans, and the industry's own anti-fraud experts said that the incidence of fraud in these loans was 90%. 90.
Wow.
After these warnings.
Now, wait a second. Was this fraud by the individual homeowners or fraud by the banks?
The answer is some of the both, but overwhelmingly by the banks, according to investigators with the state attorney generals that actually looked at these matters. And, of course, the banks could have stopped the fraud by the individuals at any time by simply verifying the borrower's income. So, you know, it was always the bank involved in these frauds.
Well, and they were running ads. I mean, I was on the air at that time. They were running ads. Got no credit, got no job, we can get you home.
Absolutely. And again, after these warnings by their own anti-fraud experts, they increased the number of liar's loans by 500% between 2003 and 2006. By 2006, 40% of all the home loans originated that year were liar's loans. Over half of all the loans called subprime were also liar's loans. They're not mutually exclusive. And at a 90% fraud incidence, that means that by 2006, just in that single year, the banks were pumping out 2 million fraudulently originated loans each year. So those are the two big fraud epidemics in loan origination. But of course, there's no fraud exorcist. So when you're going to go to sell these loans, you can't make a representation and warranty that says, "Hi, Fannie Mae, I'm selling you a bunch of fraudulent loans." So you also have to make fraudulent reps and warranties. And the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission looked at the leading entity. Now, this is the entity hired by the buyers, remember? And this entity reported to their buyers that 46% of the time, the reps and warranties were fraudulent by the sellers of mortgages. So I ask all your listeners, viewers, as such, how often would you continue to use Amazon if 46% of the time they cheated you?
Or how often would you continue to take a check from somebody if 47% of the time it bounced, it was no good?
Yeah, right. So this is the financial version of don't ask, don't tell. So it is an incredible myth of a virgin crisis conceived without sin in the C-suites. The first such crisis in world history.
Right. Now, I remember back in the late 90s when Ken Lay was riding high and taking down Gray Davis in California. And he desperately wanted to get into the banking business because he had over 800 shell companies. And the banks were starting to hassle him about the fact that he was stuffing his profits in one area and his losses in another and playing games with the IRS. He wanted to own his own bank, and he wanted to be able to trade in energy commodities in ways that didn't require a regulated marketplace to do it. And Wendy Graham had left the commodities trading board to be a member of Enron's board of directors, and her husband, Phil Graham, by coincidence, of course, in 99 and 2000, introduced two pieces of legislation, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which blew up Glass-Steagall, allowed commercial banks and gambling banks to merge, and loosened the rules on who could own a bank, so Enron could get in the banking business if they wanted, and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which said that you didn't have to actually be a counterparty to the trades, and just basically loosened the whole thing and created this giant derivatives market, this multi-hundred-trillion-dollar derivatives market. Was that the originating point of this massive fraud? Was that, those two pieces of legislation by Phil Graham, is that where it started, or was there some other point, or was there a confluence of events? So what brought this about?
It is a confluence, and yes, that was a substantial contributor. No, it wasn't the beginning. For one thing, in the story, you left out the fact that when Wendy Graham was chair of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, she changed the rules to further create a regulatory black hole for derivatives in the
That's
energy
right.
trading context.
That's right.
So
Then she went on Enron's board. Right.
In the only fairness I would add is that Phil Graham was hardly alone in the Commodities Future Modernization Act. Rubin and Summers President Clinton were very strong supporters.
Oh, Bill Clinton happily signed these things.
Of all of these things, as you say. So what was the key fact? It was in 1993. So right at the beginning of the Clinton administration. And indeed, I'm writing a book about it called Wrong Turn. This is precisely when we've had this enormous success, gotten the 1,000 felony convictions in the savings and loan debacle. And the Clinton administration comes in. It reallocates the FBI agents and the U.S. attorneys so that they're no longer working the bank fraud cases, moves them to health fraud. But the really big thing is they adopted reinventing government. And Bob Stone, who they put in charge of day-to-day running of reinventing government, has written a book, and it's fabulous on the point you're asking, because he explains how it was that Al Gore put him in charge of this. The two had never met before this meeting, and at this meeting, according to Bob Stone's book, Bob Stone told Gore, he only gave him one bit of substantive advice, and the one bit of substantive advice was, don't waste 1 second going after fraud.
Really?
I personally witnessed the next part. We were instructed as federal financial regulators that we were to refer to banks as our customers and to think of them as our customers. We were urged to create partnerships wherever possible with our customers. We were told to stop imposing, that was the word they used, regulations on our customers, and to replace them with deliberately unenforceable guidelines. And we were told that enforcement actions and criminal cases were an indication of our failings as opposed to the industry's failings.
Remarkable. You were a regulator at that time.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to hear more about that. We're talking with Professor Bill Black, William Black, excuse me, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri and University of Missouri at Kansas City. Author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He blogs over at neweconomicperspectives.org. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
neweconomicperspectives.org. The book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome back. So But Professor Black, I find this absolutely fascinating that this really originated with Bill Clinton's 1993, when he first took over the White House, reinventing government. I remember that very well, the slogans and everything. There's a perhaps apocryphal story about Clinton, in one of my books actually, reprinted his New Covenant speech, which is a very FDR speech. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not the way he governed as president. And the perhaps apocryphal story is that about 2 weeks before he went into the White House, after, you know, before he was sworn in, but long after the election, that Larry Summers, Bob Rubin, and Alan Greenspan sat him down and said, son, we know you campaigned on being an FDR, you know, going to take on the banksters, the big guys, and all this kind of stuff, but here's the facts of life. Do you think that that's what happened?
No, that story is not true.
Okay.
I can tell you what actually happened. What actually happened is that Clinton began the process of cutting the Office of Thrift Supervision staff by more than 50%, and he cut the FDIC staff, he had some help from Bush as well, by more than three quarters. When Clinton gave his first speech to financial regulators on reinventing government, his opening line was, when I was campaigning for the nomination, in other words, well before this apocryphal thing you were telling about, I got more complaints about you people than anybody else in government. Wow. And he did then go on to, you know, compliment them, saying, you must have been doing something right. Because you cleaned up this cesspool. No, from the beginning, he was a big foe of regulation. And of course, people have to remember that while Bill and Hillary Clinton did not, in fact, defraud the savings and loan in the Whitewater case, the guy who ran the savings and loan in the Whitewater case was just a classic leader of a control fraud. The place was, in fact, front-to-back fraud scheme.
Huh. So there actually was something to Whitewater.
Yes.
Huh.
He was convicted in a place where he had tremendous local sympathy.
Yeah. So was Bill Clinton, like, just some kind of libertarian or quasi-Republican? I mean,
oh yeah, I mean, he's the
he's worth $100 million now. I guess, you know, that kind of would get you there after being president.
No, I mean, he goes way back. He's the leader actually of the New Democrats.
Yeah, you're right.
And so it actually, when you look over to England, right, the prime minister,
right, New Labour,
himself on Clinton.
Yeah, yeah.
Blair.
Yeah, Blair.
Tony Blair.
Bush's poodle.
Yes,
exactly. Amazing. So meet the New Democrats, same as the old Republicans, basically. He became like Nixon.
Well, no, they specifically modeled themselves on the Republicans, except that their twist, which they thought was very clever, was finance. Much bigger emphasis on finance than on Main Street. So the traditional Republicans were Main Street, but finance, they were often politically liberal on social issues.
Right.
So they were good partners.
Right, and you can see where Robert Rubin would influence that in a big way. We'll be right back with more of Professor William Black right after this. Back, Tom Hartman here with you. Republicans hate Bill Clinton for the wrong reasons. It's that he was too Republican. He was too much like a Republican. Professor Bill Black, William Black is with us, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at, tell me if I have this right, sir, the University of Missouri at Kansas City?
Bang on.
Okay. Author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, blogging at the website neweconomicperspectives.org, along with other great bloggers like Randy Ray and Stephanie Keller and others who have been on this program. Keldern, thank you. Been on this program. So to bring this back to the present moment, we've got this fraud that was set up in a large way in 1993 with Clinton's reinventing government, was kicked into high gear at the very end of the Clinton administration with Phil Gramm's legislation, and then the banks just took the ball and ran with it for 7 years and committed massive criminal fraud internationally to the tune of trillions of dollars. Here we are today. What's going on?
Right. So, but they ran for about 15 years.
Uh-huh.
And the appraisal one, people want to really look up. Again, this is in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. You can read the fact that the appraisers actually put in writing their warning that they were being extorted to inflate appraisals in the year 2000, and this warning went to all the federal banking regulatory agencies, right? So remember, that's over a year before Enron collapses. This crisis was already a crisis.
Wow. Wow.
Now, the massive expansion, again, I would emphasize, between 2003 and 2006, the liar's loans expand 500%. And we also have great survey evidence on the appraisers. We have a survey in 2003 and a survey in 2006. In 2003, 55% of the appraisers say that they have personally been subjected to this extortion in the last calendar year. And when they run the survey again in 2006, the percentage is up to 90%. This is what we call in the biz a Gresham's dynamic. A Gresham's dynamic is when you gain a competitive advantage by cheating, and the result is that bad ethics drives good ethics out of the markets and the professions.
Right. And then I remember it was just a weird coincidence. In 2007, I was reading a book that had been written back in the late 30s, early 40s, on the history of the Great Depression. And they were talking about how the housing market started collapsing in late 1927, down in Florida, how it had inflated so much from 1920 to 27 that people were literally standing on street corners in Miami buying and selling each other, property speculatively, and the prices had gone up 1,000%, all this kind of thing. And that there was a hurricane or tornado or something came through there, and the housing market started collapsing in 27 and in early 28, it was down 30% nationwide. The collapse had gone all the way up to New York and was heading out west. And I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, if my memory is wrong on these dates, but I remember doing this on the air. I think it was late 2007. It might have been early 2008. I read a piece in the Financial Times that said, the housing starts are down over 30% this quarter. And I went on the air and I said, I'm selling all my stock. This is exactly what happened in the late 20s, and I don't think this is going to be good for the stock market. Is my recollection of those events accurate?
Yeah, it's actually even more parallel than what you've just said, because the bubble stalled completely and never grew again in 2006.
Okay.
Most people would say third quarter. Some people would say second quarter 2006. And so by 2007, prices were already declining in most parts of the United States. And in 2007, the mortgage banks, because they have no deposit insurance, find it harder to keep growing in their Ponzi schemes for the
right
reasons I've explained. They started failing at the rate in late 2006, they started failing at the rate of one a week. And by mid-2007, it was up to two or three.
Well, I remember it was about a year, year and a half that I was on the air, and people were calling up ridiculing me, saying, hey, I just made $1,000 on my so-and-so stock. And I'm like, I'm staying out of the market. And I just knew this thing was coming.
No one knows when the bust is actually, you know, which month a bust is actually going to happen. But you know that it's going to come. And, yes, there are lots of folks that got this right. I'll tell you the reaction, though, of a very conservative economist when I told him about this. Mm-hmm. He said, well, you know, so show me that you made millions of dollars. Like, I should have gone
and shorted the market
in on this. Yeah. And that would be the only way I could be credible if I was trying to profit at the expense of American homeowners.
Yeah, which is pretty bizarre. Although I'll tell you, I do own a couple thousand dollars worth of shares of VXX, which is a triple short, just for the hell of it. I mean, it's just for fun, because I think it's going to happen all over again. Professor Black, would you be available to spend the rest of the hour with us?
Yes, certainly.
Oh, that would be great. I just got a 1 minute cue here, and we're gonna have to wrap up this half hour in just a minute. We'll have a 6 minute news break at the bottom of the hour, and then we can continue. We have a couple of callers who have questions for you. And sure. Just in a word, very briefly, do you think that we're still in peril?
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't think that there'd be a U.S.-inspired collapse until we get a much stronger economy and the newest bubble. But I think there are huge problems in China, and I think that there are obvious potential problems given everything that's happening in Europe right now.
Yeah, and if Ukraine was to become a hot situation, for example.
Hotter.
Hotter.
Pretty
hot. Yep. Professor William Black is with us, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Kansas, University of Missouri at Kansas City. Author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, his website, neweconomicperspectives.org. We will be back with my questions and yours for Professor Black right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You can read William Black's, Professor Black's works over at neweconomicperspectives.org and check out his book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we are talking with Professor William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. Author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He blogs over at the neweconomicperspectives.org blog. And Professor Black, welcome back. We spent so much time in the first half hour just kind of going through the arc of history of how we got here that we never got to what I opened this thing with, which is this piece that you just wrote about how, you know, Credit Suisse has now admitted criminal activity, yet nobody's going to jail, and you're suggesting the entire country, actually, in some ways, or if I'm reading your piece right. Actually, I shouldn't try to characterize what you're saying. I should just ask you what you're saying. What have we been doing in the 7-8 years since the banking crisis began in a really serious way? What have we been doing about it, and what should we have been doing about it?
Well, people know about at least the general details of the domestic bailout that the United States engineered. What people are less likely to know about is that we also bailed out internationally. And we did this in two particularly large ways involving Switzerland. One, the two largest banks in Switzerland, Credit Suisse and UBS, were simply dead. Deeply insolvent, no way to get cash, and in particular, no way to get dollars. And the Swiss Central Bank couldn't come up with enough dollars, and they needed dollars for some of their liabilities. So the United States, through the Federal Reserve, made, in essence, an unsecured loan of many billions of dollars to the Swiss Central Bank, which then used those dollars to help bail out Credit Suisse and UBS. Now, simultaneously,
now, what year was this?
So this is back in 2008.
Okay. Pardon me.
And simultaneously, we were bringing an action against UBS, we, the Justice Department, for criminal tax fraud, aiding and abetting U.S. Tax cheats. These are, of course, very wealthy Americans who weren't willing to pay even the Bush era taxes with the dramatic reduction.
Right, because this was all happening when George Bush was president.
That is correct. And so we helped bail out entities that were actively seeking to defraud our nation. Now, the second and related thing is UBS was still in deep trouble, as were a number of other banks. So Treasury Secretary Paulson and with the support of Geithner, who would become his successor, secretly used AIG, which had failed and was under U.S. conservatorship, to bail out many large banks. Now, this is primarily the infamous one is Goldman Sachs. And remember, Paulson had come before being Treasury Secretary. He was head of Goldman Sachs. So he now used us to bail out his former firm. But it wasn't just a bunch of U.S. firms. In fact, something on the order of 40% of the money went to foreign banks. And UBS was one of them. And so UBS got $5 million. So we got a fine, which I don't remember whether it was $750 or $820 million, but somewhere in that range against UBS. But we paid them $5 billion. So in essence, we paid our own fine plus gave them walking money to the tune of over $4 billion. Right. So that was the story.
Why on earth would the Bush administration, would anybody do that?
Geithner in his new book, right? Stress Test,
right.
Where they're claiming that they saved the world and it didn't cost us anything
right.
to save the world. So that you just had to pump out lots of money to the banks. And if you avoided the next banks from failing, then eventually the economy would recover.
Well, wait a minute. We saved the world, but it didn't cost us anything to save the world. My recollection and ongoing observation is that there are millions of families who have been devastated, thrown out of work, lost their homes, literally have become homeless, divorces, suicides, homicides, child abuse. Literally millions, if not tens of millions of people have had their lives devastated by the actions of these guys. Geithner saying it didn't cost us anything?
That is correct. He says we actually made money on TARP.
Would you agree with my characterization of the consequence of this bank fraud?
Yes. It cost us over 10 million American jobs.
Wow.
The latest estimate of economists is that it will cost us 21 $1 trillion in lost production. Trillion is 1,000 billion.
Yeah.
21 trillion. And it's far worse in Europe.
And the GDP of the entire United States is only around 15 trillion, isn't it?
That is, yes, ballpark.
Yeah. Yeah. So these guys stole the GDP of the United States for a year and a half and stuck it in their pocket and walked away with it or made it vanish.
Unfortunately, if they had done that, it'd be easier to recover.
Right.
No, they created a net loss. It's like they had a big potlatch, if that's a familiar concept.
Yeah,
In which you destroy wealth at a scale never before seen in the history of the world. That's our bankers.
And they're still at it, right?
Right. Now, I don't want to suggest that they simply destroyed wealth. You are correct that they made themselves massively wealthy through these frauds as well. But the amount they gain compared to the amount they destroy is more on the range of, 1 to 10.
Amazing. Amazing. So, correct me if I'm wrong in my recollection of timelines or any of my facts, but my recollection is that Reagan essentially deregulated the SNLs in 83, in the first
82.
Year. 82, okay. And that deregulation came home to roost in 86 when the SNLs collapsed and all the fraud was exposed and the Keating Five and everything. And
in 83.
Pardon?
It was immediate effect. By 1983, there were 300 fraudulent savings and loans growing at an average rate of 50%. When you grow at an average rate of 50% with compounding, you double in size every 9 months. If re-regulation had not begun the next year, which is when it began, by the way, in the savings and loan context, you would have been facing, you know, $10, $15 trillion in losses and 10 million jobs from the savings and loan debacle.
Yeah.
As we went through earlier, the deregulation that spurred the current crisis began in 1993, and the first meaningful act, and it was only semi-meaningful, of re-regulation occurred in 2009, or at least it became effective in 2009. So that's a 16-year lag.
Wow. But when Reagan, I watched about an hour-long speech by Bill Seidman, who recently passed away, who Reagan put in charge of the Resolution Trust Corporation, was it called? You know, that basically,
yes,
they nationalized these SNLs. They fired all of the executives in these banks. The stockholders all took a bath. Got, you know, they were screwed. They protected the depositors, and then over the course of the following 20 some odd years, Bill Seidman reprivatized gradually the SNLs in a way that actually showed a profit to the United States government. At least this is how he characterized it. And they identified over 1,000 people that they wanted to prosecute. They took over 800 of them to court, and many of them, like Charles Keating famously, went to prison. Why, when this happened, when the exact same scenario, you know, of, you know, Reagan deregulating, the banks go into fraud, the banks crash, you know, when the exact same scenario happens with much bigger banks, under the watch of Clinton and Bush, when, you know, when Paulson comes out, you know, with his trembling hand saying, "I need Congress to give me trillions of dollars based on these three pieces of paper. I can't tell you all about it, but, you know, it's a, please now." Why didn't they do what Reagan did?
Yes. So I actually did this on Fox Business News, of all things, when no one, by the way, used the phrase nationalization back in that era.
But that's what he did.
It's just a receivership action, right?
Uh-huh.
And he didn't sell it back over 20 years. First, he continued a practice that we had done for 7 years.
Uh-huh.
Now, the RTC wasn't created until 1989, late 1989.
Okay.
And so that was after, you know, 5.5 years of receiverships and conservatorships doing exactly what the RTC did. But you're quite right. We always wiped out the shareholders, and we wiped out the subordinated debt holders, which is precisely what you're supposed to do. And we made the criminal referrals, and we got over 1,000 felony convictions just in cases designated as major by the Justice Department. And unlike the current folks, we hyper-prioritized to go after the 100 worst fraud schemes, which involved 300 fraudulent savings and loans and over 600 individuals. And we got a 90% conviction rate against those with the best defense lawyers in the world.
Wow,
so yes,
that's amazing. Hold that thought. We'll be back with more of William Black right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Professor William Black, former bank regulator, associate professor of economics, neweconomicperspectives.org. The best way to rob a bank is to own one. And welcome back. Professor Black, still with us. You were telling us about the incredible successes. What role did you play in all this? Were you a bank regulator at that time?
I was. I was at the staff level, the leader of the re-regulation of the savings and loan industry. And I was one of many people who worked to bring these, find the criminals, make the criminal referrals, do the investigations, and help with the prosecutions. And indeed, you ask what's different. Well, that's what's different. We made over 30,000 criminal referrals in the savings and loan debacle, which is less than 1/100th the size, given the new estimates, of the $21 trillion loss that I talked about,
right,
of the current crisis. In the same agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, in this crisis, they made zero criminal referrals.
Wow.
Okay, so this is what people don't understand and is being deliberately, they're being deliberately misled by Holder, Attorney General Holder, and even the president on these things.
That's absolutely astounding. So,
and they've never restored the criminal referral process. And so here's the key. A bank won't make a criminal referral against its own CEO. Duh. So unless the agency makes the referral, there will be no referral. There are roughly 2,000 FBI agents who investigate these kinds of cases. We have slightly over 1,000 industries in the United States. So we have two FBI agents per industry on white and elite white-collar crimes. That means, A, they can't possibly have expertise in the industries, and B, it means they can't possibly walk a beat because they'd never find anything. So they wait in their office till they get a criminal referral. Those referrals aren't going to come from the banks. They're only going to come from the regulators, and the regulators eliminated the function under President Bush.
Wow.
And Obama has not restored it. And you haven't heard a single word ever from a banking regulator or Holder, or when he was head of the criminal division, Lanny Brewer, calling on the recreation of the criminal referral process and calling for whistleblowers to come forward. Have you ever heard that?
Here's what I don't understand. This seems to make no political or economic sense. People are really PO'd. They're really angry. They're really hurt. Number one, so there's a political case to be made for perp walks. And number two, it's not good for our economy, for the banks to keep on crashing our economy. Why don't they do this? Is this a case of regulatory capture?
No. It was beyond regulatory capture.
Is this like criminal collusion by the administration?
Well, first you have to go back to, again, the Clinton and then the Bush administration, where you have Alan Greenspan in charge, and Alan Greenspan famously tells, you were talking about the Commodities Future Modernization Act.
Right.
He famously tells Brooks Lyborn, you and I are going to disagree about regulation because you think fraud is a reason to regulate. And it isn't, because the markets just automatically take care of it.
Right, yeah. The whole thing, his whole speech. I heard Bill Seidman quote that speech. We'll be right back. Hang on. We're talking to Professor William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, blogging at neweconomicperspectives.org. Professor Black, just to recap, there were serious criminal prosecutions of the SNL guys during the Reagan administration and the subsequent Bush administration, first Bush administration. There were no even attempts at prosecution of banksters when these frauds became obvious to the world in the last 2 years of the second Bush administration. Can you just quickly recap the difference between those two? And then I would ask the question, why?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, if you don't get criminal referrals, then you don't get cases. If you don't get cases, then you never look for cases. So here's what happened. The FBI was so bereft of expertise because the regulators weren't there to help. Remember, when we helped, we were adding 2,000 regulators, each of whom had dramatically greater expertise in the industry and in fraud schemes in the industry than any FBI agent.
Now, you're saying during the Bush administration basically laid off all the regulators.
No. The Clinton and Bush administrations collectively, and especially Clinton, cut the FDIC by more than 3/4, cut the Office of Thrift Supervision by more than half. But it isn't simply that. There used to be a criminal referral coordinator in every major office.
Right.
And he or she had the function of making these criminal referrals, to meet every month or every three months at most with their counterparts at the FBI to get feedback. How are you doing? Are you, you know, working this case actively? Is there anything we can help you with? And we want you push, do these cases.
Right.
That function.
And this is how you got 30,000 criminal referrals in the SNL thing that led to 1,000 convictions. Okay.
That function was eliminated.
When?
Under the Bush administration.
Under the Bush administration.
Well,
why?
They weren't making, again, they're not making any criminal referrals. So why, if you're gutting your staff by three quarters, why are you going to have experienced people doing nothing when you desperately need them to do other things?
Wow. This is organized insanity.
It is. And indeed, it's what it's like once the Greenspans of the world define fraud out of existence. Then it would be as if I went to my colleagues in zoology at University of Missouri, Kansas City, and said, please come with me. I want to hunt for unicorns.
Right.
Everybody knows unicorns don't exist, right? So you'd look at the person like a crazy person if he said there was fraud.
Right. Because Greenspan famously told Brooksley Bourne, you think fraud's a bad thing. We don't think it's a bad thing because fraud is what causes markets to self-correct. People are worried about their reputations, and if they get they get their hands slapped, they'll start behaving right. This is Ayn Rand. This is libertarian theology.
It's actually far worse than Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand, von Mises, and von Hayek all explicitly say that the government must act to prevent fraud.
Right.
This is the acolyte generation that is far worse than the originals, right? The saints.
This is the libertarians.
Well, yeah,
yeah,
but this is the mindless stuff. But it isn't just Greenspan. So the leading text to this day in which young lawyers or law students are taught the law and economics of corporate law is by Judge Frank Easterbrook and Daniel Fischel. And it says explicitly a rule against fraud is not necessary or even particularly important in the securities context because markets just automatically exclude fraud. Now, the kicker in all of that, if you think that isn't insane enough, is Fischel was the consultant for Charles Keating, SunTrust, and for Drexel Burnham Lambert. All three accounting control frauds.
Right.
He tried his theories in the real world. He ended up praising Lincoln Savings as the best savings and loan in America.
That was Charles Keating's bank.
That was Charles Keating's bank.
Of the Keating Five, who almost took down John McCain with him.
Right. He was as wrong as it is humanly possible to be wrong. And then he wrote that sentence that I just quoted. And without ever telling the reader, oh, by the way, we tried this theory, and so sorry.
Yeah, everything fell apart. So in the 2 minutes we have left, William Black, what are the lessons to take out of this, and what are your predictions for the future, if you don't mind?
We still haven't fixed the things that create the criminogenic environments that produce wide-scale fraud. So first, compensation. Right. It isn't simply that compensation is large, although that's important. It is still overwhelmingly short-term reported earnings, which are the easy ones to create through accounting fraud. So that's the first area. The second area, the three Ds, deregulation, desupervision, and de facto decriminalization. We've been talking about all of those.
Right. We need to roll back all three of those.
We have to roll back the three of those, and then you have to be absolute death on anything that allows aggression's dynamic. You must intervene vigorously as regulators when you get a warning from the appraisers saying we're being extorted to inflate the appraisals, because otherwise you will get not just significant fraud, but as I demonstrated to you, 90% fraud incidents.
Do you think we're in a stock market bubble right now?
Yeah, but I don't think a particularly huge stock market bubble as these things go, because, again, the economy isn't sufficiently robust. and there's no super thing, new alleged super new thing, you know, like right. the high-tech stuff.
Right.
So I think it's going to get considerably worse.
So, yeah, this is, I've heard from people, you know, expect it to go up another 10-20% and then boom. But who knows when or how.
That's right.
Yeah. Professor William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. His book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. You can find it at all the local, all the usual sources. He blogs over at neweconomicperspectives.org. His Twitter is William K. Black. Professor Black, thank you.
Thank you, and it's the updated edition of the book that discusses the current crisis.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The third hour of our program. I thought we had a rant ready about rolling back Taft-Hartley. Anyway, what is going on in the world today? I got to tell you. By the way, Maya Angelou has died. Maya Angelou. This is a sad day. She was just an absolutely extraordinary person. There's Think Progress has five things about Maya Angelou that most people won't talk about. The esteemed poet, writer, and actress. Number one, she was a close associate with Malcolm X prior to his assassination. She was leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She supported Cuban leader Fidel Castro. And she, she said, she once wrote, "Wasn't no communist country that put my grandpapa in slavery. Wasn't no communist lynched my papa or raped my mama." She said she was quoting as black people often said. She was a staunch advocate for marriage equality. And made a strong moral case for action to recover the kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls. So. Oh, yeah, that's right. let's see what we have here. John in Colton, California. Hey, John. Thanks for hanging on. I'm sorry we didn't get to any calls with Professor Black. It just kept coming, you know, the more and more mind-boggling things. I know you wanted to ask him a question, but what's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
It might be a little off topic Professor Black was talking about, but I heard a program last night on my local Pacifica station on KPFK talking about Ellen Brown. She's talking about like public banks.
Mm-hmm.
How they would be much more better than, like, you know, Bank of America, where it would work, you know, works for North Dakota, where they don't run any deficits, I believe, or I'm not a banking expert, but.
Yeah, here's how it works, and I've had Ellen Brown on this program a couple of times. Hang on, I'm trying to get my chair adjusted here so I can get myself up to the microphone. Ellen Brown's been on the program a number of times. I've read her book. She's absolutely right. Banks are enormously profitable businesses. There's a reason why all these banksters are making hundreds of millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in some cases. And they handle mind-boggling amounts of money, particularly when they do businesses for states, like, you know, the various banks that deal with California's pension funds, and just California's just paying the bills every day. You're talking about literally hundreds of billions, perhaps even trillions of dollars every year. And if your fees are just a fraction of a percent of that, you're talking really serious money. And the fees in many cases are far more than just a fraction of a percent. And so what happened back in the 19-aughts or the 19-teens, my recollection is it was around 1917, 1918, but anyhow, back in that era, was that South Dakota created a public bank, and it was in the wake of the great crash of 1898, and when most of the banks in America failed. And in North Dakota or South Dakota, do you remember which one it is, which Dakota it is?
Yeah, it's North Dakota.
Okay, North Dakota. That's what I thought. In North Dakota, the banks really weren't back on their feet, and the farmers needed the banks in order to, in the spring, borrow enough money to buy enough wheat or whatever it was that they were growing to plant,
right,
and then they'd pay it back in the fall. So these were originally, it was set up for the farmers. And so what they did, what the state did, was they chartered a state-owned bank and set it up so that all the profit would roll back into the state treasury. And they offered loans to farmers at below market rates, and it's worked out very well. And it's, that bank is still there, and it's still doing business in the state, and still loaning money to farmers and small business people, and it handles the money of the state, and so the state makes a profit on its own banking transactions, and that profit goes back into its own coffers, and so they don't have to raise taxes on their individuals. So, you know, if you live in California, you know, a good chunk of your taxes, your state income taxes that you're paying, are going to Bank of America. They're going to Jamie Dimon and his buddies on Wall Street.
Yeah.
And so Ellen Brown is saying California, if California had their own bank, they could dramatically cut their income taxes, or they could dramatically increase the state's services simply by getting rid of all the fees that they're giving to the banksters who, as William Black so eloquently pointed out over the last hour, have been robbing us blind for the last 30 some odd years.
Exactly. That's, you know, that's the thing I was astounded to hear. I'd never heard of that before. And I mean, it could be done anywhere.
It could be done in any state. The problem is, I have a friend who's very active in this in the state of Oregon, where they're trying to get the legislature to set up a state-owned bank. And the problem is that the banksters come in and they lobby the legislators really aggressively, and banksters have a lot of money, and they can make a lot of threats. And so they've got the carrot and they've got the stick. And the banksters do not want this to happen. They do not want it to happen anywhere. And so far they've prevented it from happening anywhere. And there are now you've got people who are looking at ballot initiatives to force it on the ballot to create a state bank, or to force the legislature to create a state bank against their will, so that they can get around. And this is the whole reason why the ballot initiatives were also written into the Oregon and other state constitutions. About 20 some odd states have ballot initiatives.
Yeah.
And then they all came into place between basically 1898 and 1920. And it was because they needed to get around these corrupt legislators who had been bought off by the robber barons of the Gilded Age. And this was the tail end of that. So, John, thanks for the call, and thanks for pointing it out. It's a great topic. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi. One of the frustrating things about a lot of documents, such as the Constitution, is we really need to know the etymology and the audience of the time. It's like when you look in the Bible, as you know, what the audience was and the etymology, you find it's an entirely different document than a lot of people think. And so I really wish the Constitution was annotated. And one day I was looking at the Second Amendment, and all of a sudden realized I'd never really looked at the term bear arms. And the term bear was really important. I looked at, couldn't think of that actually being used in a situation except basically in a militaristic sense, and started looking things up. And there is actually
a weapon.
Debate. Yeah, but in a military sense. I mean, you say bear arms. I mean, you know, people are just going out hunting generally don't use that term.
Right, right.
And if you look, there is actually a debate that bare arms was meant to be. Yeah, you know, it's not a settled debate by any means. But there's a debate whether that was actually referring to as an organized military force.
Well, I think it's a subtle debate. I mean, there's a new book out called The Second Amendment, a Biography. And last night on the TV show, I interviewed the author of it. I'm sorry I'm blanking on his name. It's the one and only time I've spoken with him. But I read about a third of the book before I interviewed him. And it totally blew my mind. When the Second Amendment was put together, in the meeting that they had, the organizing debate, there were 20 speeches given about this. And not one of them once mentioned personal defense, hunting, or target shooting. Every single one of those 20 speeches was about defending the nation in a military context. And the debate of whether there should be state militias or there should be a federal militia, and whether there should be a standing army during time of peace or not. And that was entirely the debate. And then that was on the early draft of the Second Amendment, which then got rewritten in 1790, whatever year it was, when Patrick Henry objected to it in Virginia, and James Madison changed it from "for the security of a free country" to "the security of a free state," because Patrick Henry was afraid that they would use the Article 1, Section 8 to strip the slave patrols from the states. Jeff, thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, it's the Second Amendment has a long and twisted, and truly twisted, given its roots in slavery history. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I was just telling Shane I've got a 1790s dictionary, and that's how I discovered that the word privacy did not mean privacy in 1790. It's in the dictionary, but it's dealt with like it's a word that we don't talk about in polite company. Kirk in Bothell, Washington, listening on 91.3 FM KBCS. Hey, Kirk, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, wanted to also have this conversation when Professor Black was there, but obviously that opportunity is gone. But I know you've spoken positively of the Clinton campaign in 2016, and given all of the horrible stuff that we just heard last hour from Professor Black about the first Clinton administration perpetuating this problem and really exacerbating it in a lot of ways, it's given me pause to be willing to endorse a 2016 Clinton campaign, particularly given the effectiveness that Bill and Hillary have had in populating President Obama's administration with former Clinton hacks. You know, Eric Holder, I guess, being the most egregious example that was given last hour. How can we in good conscience, put another 20 years at risk and our children's future and potentially our democracy,
right,
when we're probably signing up for more of the same?
Kirk, on its face, I absolutely agree with you. And this is why whenever I talk about the possibility of Hillary Clinton running for president, there are some caveats that I put on this. And I would remind you that FDR, who was the president who really saved America and transformed America into a modern democracy, into a modern, the modern functional welfare state, democratic socialist state to a certain extent, with unionization and social security and regulated banking and all these other things. FDR, before he became president, was the governor of arguably the most, if not the second most, corrupt state in the entire United States. And the stuff that was going on Wall Street when FDR was governor was what caused the Great Depression. And FDR, as governor, had some influence over the Attorney General of the state of New York, who had direct control, the direct ability to prosecute Wall Street guys, and he did not. And so, you know, FDR's rap sheet when he became president was far worse than anything that Bill and Hillary Clinton have. And yet, the people were standing up so loudly and so strongly in 1933, and he had the good fortune to have Frances Perkins in as his Secretary of Labor, which is a kind of another story. It's a great book about her. The woman who created the New Deal, the story of Frances Perkins. But the people were up in arms, and so he had to respond. And that's why I keep saying I don't believe in the great man theory of history. You could make Ralph Nader president, and he might be corrupted by the office. On the other hand, you could put a fairly corrupt guy like FDR into the White House, and when the people are demanding reform, you'll get reform. And so that's why, you know, it doesn't matter, I don't think, so much whether it's Hillary Clinton or anybody else. My preference would be Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. But even if it's Hillary Clinton, if enough of us get involved, if enough of us show up, if there's a popular, essentially uprising, a political revolution, then she will have no choice but to go along with it. Kirk, thanks for the call. Let me just kind of restate this, because, Bill Black was pretty unambiguous that Bill Clinton's 1993 Reinventing Government initiative, which he put Al Gore in charge of, by the way, if you'll recall, those of you old enough to remember the early years of the Clinton administration. A large part of that had to do with deregulating the banks and cutting back on agencies in the government. You know, it was a very, very kind of Republican concern. This is the New Democrats. And so the genesis of today's disastrous economy and the crash and everything really, you know, it was put on steroids, certainly by Phil Graham with Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. But Bill Clinton enthusiastically signed both of those, too. But back in 93, he was doing Robert Rubin's work and Alan Greenspan's, you know, deregulating the banks. And so somebody calls up and says, well, you know, given that and how Bill Clinton has managed to make himself into a multimillionaire now since he left the White House, how could you possibly support a Hillary candidacy? And my point, we need to remind ourselves of this over and over and over again. There's no saviors. We have to save ourselves. This salvationistic thinking that is part and parcel, frankly, of most of our major religions. Jesus is going to return, say the Christians. Mashiach is, you know, coming back, say the Jews, some of them. Muhammad is going to return, say some Muslims. I mean, you know, this messianic, somebody will save us thinking migrates into our political world. And we see it in the business world. Oh, you know, this is how they sell us this myth of the job creator, this nonsense about job creators. Oh, yeah, you know, if only the right guy would take over our company or would start a company, if only another Steve Jobs came along. Well, did you know that Steve Jobs was colluding with a couple of other companies to drive down wages in Silicon Valley and screw workers? So, yeah, Louise just walked in and said, if only Obama would become president. We were all saying this in 2008. Then everything will be perfect. Right? Remember that? Or maybe in 2012, if only he gets reelected, then he'll be able to really be himself. There are no saviors. Franklin Roosevelt was governor of New York before he became president of the United States. FDR, the guy that I don't think anybody could successfully argue that FDR didn't save this country. And I'm not talking about World War II. I'm talking about the Great Depression. FDR saved this country. And he created the modern social democracy, whatever you want to call it, democratic socialist, if you want. I know that the right-wingers will go nuts if I use that phrase. But there is some truth to that. You know, Social Security, the right to unionize, these are things where society's needs are at concern as much as any individual's needs and therefore qualify as being at least in some small way socialist rather than libertarian, rather than just, you know, hey, I got mine, screw you. FDR, the president, with the help of Frances Perkins, his Secretary of Labor, and this new biography about her is really worth reading. FDR saved this country. Excuse me. As governor of New York, his attorney general, whose name I don't recall, merrily let Wall Street get away with incredible amounts of criminal activity in 1928 and 29. Actually, I should go back and look at the years. I'm not sure what years he was governor of New York. But the fact of the matter is that he was governor of New York when it was an incredibly corrupt state, which included right up until 1932. And he could have been just another corrupt president. It wasn't FDR who saved America. It was the people. It was we the people. I write about this in my book, The Crash of 2012. I went, or 2016. I went back and read the New York Times archives from 1933, from March of 1933. I read day by day by day, and I read I started with March of 33 when FDR was sworn into office and read right through most of that year. Spent weeks doing this. And there was a woman reporter, and I'm forgetting her name. This is all in my book, in the crash of 2016. There was a woman reporter who had, she was one of the very first female reporters of the New York Times. She was a real force to be reckoned with. And she was writing these front page headline all the way across the top stories about the early FDR administration in the first 100 days. And she chronicled how every member of Congress was buried in paper. Their offices were buried in paper from the telegrams that were coming in from all over the country from people saying, give him whatever he wants. FDR said, I'm going to reinvent this country. We're going to make it, we're going to remake it anew. You'll recall he said, you know, to some generations, much is given, of other generations, much is asked. This generation has a rendezvous with destiny. People think he was talking about World War II. No, that was from his inaugural address. He was talking about the Great Depression. And the people overwhelmingly said, do it! And he did it. And so that's why I don't think, you know, I think around the margins, it matters if the president is Hillary Clinton or Elizabeth Warren. I think going into it, it matters probably in a much larger way. And certainly the president can screw things up. Just look at George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan. But if we, the people, are active enough and strong enough, it doesn't matter who's in that office.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Because we will make them do it right. Len, case in point, Republican Dwight Eisenhower. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And oh, what a day. What a fascinating day. We're learning so much. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence. The zombie apocalypse is upon us?
Of course. You know, if you put together your news, you can see it. You can see that the army is practicing for a zombie apocalypse. Well, they say they're practicing.
Well, if I may interrupt you, not everybody hears our newscast. People listening to us on radio don't hear our newscast. So let me just, in a couple of sentences, tell people what you're talking about. The U.S. Army had a training exercise that was not just the Army, it was the armed forces, to how to respond to a zombie apocalypse. And it brought in all these different branches of the military. And you know, how do they coordinate with each other? How do they communicate with each other? And the reason they used a zombie apocalypse was they didn't want to use a real thing that might be happening because it could get confusing. You know, like there was actually a real drill going on in 9/11, and there were some people who thought the 9/11 was just a drill. And so they made it a zombie apocalypse so it would be absurd enough that everybody would know. But they still got an opportunity to test out their equipment and stuff. Okay, back to you, Lawrence.
Okay, sure. That's what they say, that it's only a drill. But when you put it together with the rest of the news, for instance, the fact that Republicans want fracking to go on and are preventing any kind of chemical regulation about fracking or about anything else.
Right, North Carolina, they want to put you in jail if you reveal the chemicals that they use.
Exactly. And when you put that together with the fact of radiation increasing and the Republicans want atomic energy rather than solar energy, when you put that together with the fact that they refuse to regulate poisoning in our food,
right,
and that the fact that they're promoting global warming, and the fact that they're promoting gun deaths, and the fact that they're opposing health care, it's obvious that they're preparing for a very large number of deaths under conditions of chemical poisoning and radiation poisoning. Obviously, they're training an army of zombies, which the army will then combat in order to replace the wars that the Kenyan Muslim communist has eliminated in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Either that or the zombie apocalypse is already upon us.
Well, that may be. Certainly,
and the zombies are called Republicans.
Yes, but you know, they're extending it to the entire population, and it's clear that people will not simply die, but they will be poisoned by chemicals and poisoned by radiation and then return as zombies. And the Army's got to fight something.
Yeah.
So it really puts all the news together.
Indeed. Lawrence, brilliant. Thank you very much. Marie in Carbondale, Colorado. Hey, Marie, what's up?
Thanks for the conversation with Professor Black. That was absolutely fascinating.
I agree.
I want to move from ideology, though, to something really practical.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope you'll excuse me, but I suspect there are a lot of other folks in the same situation. My husband and I are low-income professionals. He's a teacher. I'm a pastor. We lost our shirts in 2008. And then in 2009, my salary was reduced to half. We're both about to retire now. My pension has been cut in half as a result because it's based on the last 3 years of employment. We're terrified of going into debt right now. We're looking, trying to find a house to live in. I'm losing my employee housing. And we're scared to death of taking out a bank loan at this point. We read 2016. We've tried to pay attention to economists. Our financial advisor keeps saying, oh, no, take the loan. Don't pull money out of the stock market right now.
Right.
We're going round and round about it, and we have to make a decision in 2 weeks. What's your best advice?
I don't give advice like that, Marie. First of all, the main reason I don't give advice like that is because I have not been a good steward of my own money over the years. I've, typically when I've tried to play the market, I've lost. And when I've done well, it's because I just got lucky. And secondly, I don't want to take on the responsibility of somebody else's debt. In the abstract, though, I think that there are the consideration that you raise. This kind of a situation is a situation that a lot of people who are nearing retirement age are facing, because they or we, speaking as somebody who's, I'm 63, we are the last generation really before Reagan started stripping the middle class of wealth. And so we're the generation that's going into retirement with maybe enough money to actually buy a house and pay it off and have a little bit left over to live on for a few years. And so, what do you do about that, or what do you do with that? And I don't have an easy answer. I mean, I've heard a couple of different theories about this. One is you go in debt as deeply as you can with the kinds of debt that you can walk away from, that you can repudiate. And, if everything goes to hell in a handbasket, then you can just walk away from the debt, from the loan. The other is get entirely out of debt. The problem with owning land, though, if you're out of debt, is that you can't actually own land in the United States. You can only lease it from the government, and the lease payment is called property taxes. And if you fail to pay the property taxes, they will take that land back. And they can take back $500,000 house because you owe $5,000 in property taxes, and if you're sufficiently late. So it becomes a tricky thing, and so that's where I don't know how to advise you. Am I making sense here, Marie?
Yes, it is.
The one thing I do know is that the people who get hurt the worst during times of economic crash or disaster are the people in the middle, the people who are either not debt, the people who are half in debt and have some assets, but they have also debts that roughly equal their assets. Somebody who's got a house that's worth $200,000 and they got a $100,000 mortgage on it and they got $30,000 in the bank. That's the person who's going to get wiped out when everything falls apart because they can't afford to pay off their house. They don't have enough money to live on. And if they walk away from that debt, they're still not going to have enough to be able to go forward. And in fact, it could be, you know, taken back away from them in a successful legal action. So, that's everything that I know about it. I would suggest that you listen to your financial advisor. And
really? Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not saying make the choice that he suggested that you said he suggested. I'm saying listen to somebody who knows more about this than I do because I'm not a financial advisor. That's what I'm saying. Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Marie. Thanks for the call. Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan. What's up?
Great to talk with you once again, Tom. Just curious if you ever did happen to catch back in, I believe it ran in March the first time on Free Speech, and it was Jeremy Ripkin's Money to Burn. But on that show, none other than our latest new bobblehead chairperson, looking a bit like Buddy Hackett, Janet Yellen and her friend Alice Rifkin, sat there going, well, we knew it looked kind of awkward. In other words, Hank Paulson's, you know, the whole right. thing was all falling down. We threw it up, and she does these weird oogly eyes, and it's like, but I'm also curious why QUETAM was taken away. That was what you guys were trying to come up with. That was when you had whistleblower status.
Right.
I had a medical predicament that as I went forward with all this stuff, I mean, through the FBI, through, at that time they had end fraud through the Medicare.
Right.
Highlighting how my gastroenterologist, like it was baseball cards, started selling my colonoscopy as Mrs. Smith's colonoscopy.
Yeah.
Yet none of that was
You know, Susan, I honestly, I don't know. Thanks for reminding me about Money to Burn, and thank you for the call. And I remember learning about QUETAM at one point and thinking, this is really fascinating, but I don't remember enough details about it to give you an intelligent answer. So I'm going to have to go back and read the Wikipedia page or something again. Leon in Heathsville, Virginia. Hey, Leon, what's up?
Hey, Fukushima, I've fought landfills, and they use liners. But what you can do is drill peripheral wells and pump water out to keep the natural aquifers from penetrating the contamination.
I think Fukushima has gone way beyond that because they've got at least one core that has melted into the earth.
Yeah, but they can take the aquifer pressure off of it if they drill wells on the periphery of it and pump the water out before it hits there. And
yeah, they're also right on the surface right on the edge of the ocean there, so I don't know. Interesting point, Leon. Thank you for calling and sharing it. Russ in Hanover Park, Illinois. What's up, Russ?
Hey, Tom. Earlier today and yesterday, you were talking about gun control legislation and things like that and how all the right-wingers, their favorite whipping boy for that is the folks in Chicago.
Right.
How there's so many guns available, even though Chicago has such strict gun laws.
Right.
And you were kind of touching on the answer a little bit, but yesterday a report came out, and in fact it was reported on WCPT, that we have some information now that we can throw back at these right-wingers.
Okay. Go for it quick. We're running out of time here, Russ.
Okay. Apparently 60% of the guns that are confiscated in arrests originated legally purchased in states with lax gun laws, and another 20% were actually sold in four suburban gun shops in the
wow.
area.
Wow. So basically,
and one in Gary, Indiana.
The reason why the poor neighborhoods in Chicago have a gun problem and the poor neighborhoods in New York City don't is because New York City is surrounded by states and counties and townships that have strong gun laws, and Chicago is surrounded by libertarian areas that don't have strong gun laws. Thank you for that, Russ.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
80%. Great number. Thank you so much. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Lincoln in Mount Vernon, New York, listening on WBAI. Hey, Lincoln, what's up? Lincoln, you are on the air. I think Lincoln is listening to his radio. There is a delay. Okay. I'm going to put Lincoln on hold here, and we'll see what's going on. Richard in Whittier, California, listening to KPFK. Richard, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about salvation and what it really means in the Bible.
Sure.
And how the religion of empire or orthodoxy has taken it and turned into something else. Salvation in the Bible is about liberation from oppression. We have the Exodus from Egypt. This is a highly oppressed group of people, and this literature came out of that oppression and that struggle for freedom and release from captivity.
Right.
And that's why it's valuable. And so the other thing I wanted to talk about was how people think that,
hang on just a second. Though, if you're responding to my riff was that the way that we're sold this is that there is a person who is going to be responsible for that salvation. And what I'm saying is that we're not waiting for Moses to lead us out of the promised land. In fact, I would argue that if we could step into a time machine and go back, assuming that the story of Moses has some historical accuracy, that probably there was a whole bunch of people pushing Moses really, really hard to lead the parade out. It wasn't that he was pulling people, they were pushing him, because that's typically how it works.
And that's the same reason why third-party candidates don't really matter. What matters is the party and who's going to caucus with you and whether we can get in power.
Yeah.
And if we're not working with the Democratic Party, then we're hurting ourselves, because that's our best way to get power. And the Progressive Caucus is one of the largest caucuses in the Democratic Party.
That's correct.
So, yeah. So if we're wasting our time, I mean, it's nice to listen to third-party candidates, but hey, we need to get in power. We have a strong Republican opposition that's going to crush us at times, and we need to get unified, organized, and work together with the party that gives us the best chance of taking power. And then once we take power, then we can work from there and start to make the changes we want.
Well, and this was the Tea Party strategy. This is how the billionaires took over the Republican Party. It's how the Koch brothers took over the Republican Party, was, you know, have the Tea Party at the local level, literally at the level of the precinct committee person, take over the local parties, nominate, you know, for every primary, nominate four or five different Tea Party candidates. It didn't matter which one won. They were all Tea Partiers, and boom, you've got a Tea Party caucus in the Republican Party. Progressives need to be doing the same thing inside the Democratic Party, in my humble opinion.
That's absolutely right, and I think Christians need to be organizing, too, to create something like a Tea Party, but not a Tea Party, so that we can use our faith to energize us and help us fight for liberation and freedom based on Christ, who died on the cross in a protest because of what he said. So this is a Jesus.
I agree. I think that each one of us, when we're looking at political action, has to find the thing that animates us. What's the thing that makes you the most excited? And for you, Richard, it's your Christianity. It's the, you know, presumably, you know, Matthew 25, the great commandments. For others, it might be global warming, or it might be panda bears or whatever. To find the thing that animates you, find a group of people who agree with that, and then get all of you inside a political party. Thank you, Richard. Welcome back, Kyle Harbin here with you, Lincoln, in Mount Vernon, New York. Do you want to try it again? Listen to WBAI?
Yeah. Hey. Hello. How are you?
Lincoln, how you doing?
Okay. I think we the people make a big mistake, and we keep excusing these politicians. I hear what you're saying about the people must make the politicians do it, but I think it's a big excuse when we say, why do you vote for someone and you have to make them do it? Obviously, if you vote for someone and you have to make them do it, you voted, or we voted for the wrong person.
No. The construct that you're using assumes that voting is what you do, is the way that you participate in a democracy. And I would suggest to you that voting is the least important thing you do in a democracy.
No, that's not the point I'm making, though. The point I'm making is, apart from we the people actually constantly being involved, I'm saying that we should stop making excuses for people we know who don't truly represent us. Because if they don't truly represent us, we should not vote for them. Like even Obama, he was using that that other president's thing when he said, make me do it. Make you do it. You come in here talking about change. Why should I make you do it?
Yeah.
That should be your should be your plan. You should be planning to do it for me if you are really in there for the people. We, the people, should seek people who want to truly be our servants, and we should reorganize government so government functions as servant of the people.
And Lincoln, when enough people are speaking like you are, you will see that change. You will absolutely see that change. I don't disagree with you. This has to exist collaterally at two different levels. Thank you for the call. Very well said. Craig in Jamaica, New York. Craig, you're on the air.
Tom, I wanted to, I guess, piggyback off the FDR thing you were talking about, because I can remember times when I think A. Philip Randolph used to go to FDR, and he was making requests. He was the guy for the Pullman porters, and FDR used to say, if you want me to do it, make me do it.
Right.
Whatever that meant, you know.
A. Philip Randolph was the source of that story.
What's that?
A. Philip Randolph was the source of that story about FDR.
Right, right. And it's probably other people who would come to him with all kinds of requests. And he says, well, it's not on the table right now, but if you manipulate the situation and push hard enough, you can get me to do it. But I wanted to say one other thing. Since you were talking about the zombie attack, another friend of mine gave me an idea about extrapolating on the career paths of Mr. Snowden and Lee Harvey Oswald. It was sort of a strange overlay. I said, no, their careers aren't exactly the same.
Well, they were both spies.
I didn't make mention of it, especially since Kerry is asking him to come back to the country immediately.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We'll see how it plays out. But that's just a couple of things.
Yeah, it's interesting. This apparently it's going to be played tonight on television. On, I think, ABC at 10 o'clock, this interview with Ed Snowden, and I'm looking forward. I'm probably going to stay up and watch it. Craig, thanks a lot for the call, and then we can talk about it tomorrow. Andrew in Hollywood, listening on KPFK. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
Two quick things. First, my take on Obama, while we can all be pretty critical of the job he's doing, I don't think it's his fault. I think I remember when he was getting into office, and maybe right after he got in, he put out a call for us to participate more and to back him and to take local action, as you've been discussing. I think that's the solution. So I don't think we really stepped up enough to let him get the job done.
Yeah, okay. Now let me argue against myself. Let us not blame the victim either, okay? I mean, you know, it's important for us to point out that we need to be in the streets and we need to be pushing the president and all of our elected officials. And on the other hand, they have an obligation to keep their campaign promises.
Sure, if they can. I don't think he could.
But you wanted to talk about California initiatives for public banking?
Yeah. I want to continue on that. I saw that special on KPFK last night on with Ellen Brown, and people can see that in the archives for kpfk.org. But anyway, on something's happening. Other stuff that she said was that it's just been ruled that in California, at least, that, first of all, Mendocino County is going forward with an initiative, so they may get a locally owned bank there, a public bank. But also it was just ruled that in California, charter cities such as San Francisco, Los Angeles, and others can now do their own banks as well.
Oh, that is super cool. That is super cool. And, I mean, you know, San Francisco and Los Angeles, their banks, I mean, there are cities that have populations that are larger than many states. I mean, Vermont has 600,000 people. Oklahoma has 700,000 people, as I recall. Wyoming, 600,000 or 700,000 people. So, yeah, that would be super cool. Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. Zabby, and sorry to cut you off, but I've still got six people on hold here, and I've got 2 minutes. Zabby, in Selden, New York, listening to WBAI. What's up, Zabby?
Hey there. Yes, I'm in Suffolk County, New York, Long Island, mm-hmm. and I wanted to rally people to for the to save WBAI. I have a website. You can Google Zabby, Z for Zorro, A for Apple, BB for Brilliant, Y for Yes, and Suffolk, Suffolk, S-U-F-F-O-L-K, and you will come up with a website called runprimaries.webs.com, homerunprimaries.webs.com. Click on that. You'll see an article where I have some ideas for raising money for WBAI, and
that,
I'd like
that
to
is absolutely
Tom.
That is absolutely great.
And I'd like to ask you, Tom, to be one of the people to personally go out and ask and maybe beg for anonymous contributions from wealthy people that you may, in fact, run across and come across, even when you invite them on your
show. Zabby, you just made that appeal to 3 million people. So I wish you the very best with it. Good luck. Thank you very much for the call. We will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, for another 6 hours of nonstop radio. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you to show up and participate. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.